Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ambaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Brenda Ainslie, Chair, IFIP IP3, and Global Authority in ICT. Brenda, you have an amazing background. Just remarkable, all the things that you've accomplished throughout your incredible career. And I know you're very, very busy, very tight schedule. So thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences with our audience.
It's my pleasure. And thank you, Stephen, for inviting me to speak with you today.
Brenda, can you profile your education and work history and provide some defining and usable lessons that you wish to share from some of the major events and roles in your history?
Well, it's an interesting question that you asked me because I don't know what people's career paths are like today, but I've had several careers in my work life, all of them to do with communications, communications of the sort that involves talking and listening. I left school at 15 and worked for the Postmaster General's Department as a telephonist in those days of cord and plug manual exchanges. And over the next few years, I moved around Australia and up to semi-automatic and eventually automatic exchanges. And even at that young age, I learned that learning each day what I needed to know to become more efficient and effective as a telephonist satisfied a need in me. Curiosity may have killed the cat, as the saying goes, but it's absolutely certain that satisfaction brought this cat back to life. I say even today that a day without learning is a day wasted. In my second career in the public service, firstly in uniform during the Vietnam era, and then as a civilian, I learned that good time management and excellent organisational skills were simply evidence of a working smarter, not harder philosophy. And Stephen, you might be familiar with C. Northcote Parkinson, who said that work expands to fill the time available. Well, he was absolutely correct. And another lesson that life has shown me is that if you do not work smart, you'll not achieve your goals. So in my current career in ICT and as a project manager and educator and an advocate for professionalism, I have finally learned what today's newest worker seems to know instinctively, and that whatever you do, you must be passionate about it. I returned to formal learning in my 20s. I confess to having hated school. It bored me, although today I'm very grateful for the foundational learning that I did have, and I'm a very strong advocate for the five R's, the reading, writing, arithmetic, respect and responsibility. I regret probably that I never did sciences at school, and it's a funny story that took me away from my childhood passion, geology, and into biology. What would I be today if only I had found the right schoolroom where those who were passionate about rocks were gathered? In 1974, I returned to matriculate and head off to university the following years, and I earned my first degree in the arts with majors in politics and sociology, both of which I've used every day and since then. These are life skills to assist in understanding your environment, equally as essential as maths and physics, to the understanding of the physical universe in which we live. I learned that the last two R's were vital to succeeding at university, respect and responsibility, because as an adult learner, your success was almost entirely in your own hands. If you lacked either of these qualities in sufficient strength, then you would not achieve the outcome you went to university for. I earned my first practice qualification in computing in vocational education, funnily enough, and not at university. But I went on to do university postgraduate studies and came out with a diploma in applied science in computing. So another lesson that I learnt was that university education is as valid a form of learning as is vocational education, and I promote in equal measure both of those pathways. Sorry, a bit long-winded in there, but I feel it's important, some important lessons in there to share with the audience.
Brenda, due to your remarkable background, you've done so much, you've led so many programs, and both on a regional and global basis, you have been invited for significant positions at the IFIP World Computing Congress. For example, you are on the International Program Committee, you're chairing sessions, and you're also speaking at this UN-founded event, the UN-founded event, again, being the IFIP World Computing Congress, which is going to be held in September from the 24th to 26th. What are your objectives at the IFIP World Computing Congress 2012, and what should ICT professionals, what should they be looking for in terms of participation at this event? Why should they attend?
Well, Stephen, I'm glad you asked this question because it's less than 4 weeks away to this particular event, and I'm leading a session on the last day on professionalism in ICT in 2020. And the role of e-skills, competence, and frameworks in defining the profession. It's an all-morning session, unlike the rest of the program, and involves 10 speakers, 9 of whom will speak individually, and then act as a panel to interact with the audience. The final segment of the session is a call to action from me for participants to work together to advance the cause of professionalism in ICT practice, to ensure that we reach our goal of being recognised as a global profession by 2020. I think today we are on the road to that recognition, but we're not there yet, and the journey is still underway, and I invite ICT professionals to take that journey with us.
You have been a long-time member of the Australian Computer Society, or ACS. Can you profile your roles with the ACS and what the ACS is?
Yes, the ACS has been a significant part of my life since 1999. It's the recognised professional association for those working in information and communications technology, in Australia obviously, and it seeks to raise the standard of ICT professionals and represent their view to government, industry and the community. It is a member of the Australian Council of Professions, along with the lawyers, the doctors, etc. The ACS sets itself up to be the guardian of professional ethics and standards within the ICT sector. It's committed to ensuring the beneficial use of ICT for all Australians. And its purpose is to provide both members and non-members with opportunities for professional education, for networking and certification, as well as enabling them to contribute to the development of their profession. ACS is a federation. It's made up of branches from the 8 states and territories of Australia. I have been a chairman of the South Australian branch 1999 and 2001, and again in 2004 to 2006, with responsibility for providing services to the South Australian members of ACS. I've also been an ongoing member of the Executive Committee since 1999, and I currently enjoy the role as Honorary Branch Secretary. On a national level, I've been Vice President twice, in 2002-03 and again in 2010-11. In the second case, I was the Vice President Membership, which responsibility included continuing professional developments, professional standards, and the membership lifecycle and marketing board activities. So it's a kind of a cradle to grave for members with my bailiwick. And in my time there, we introduced the current iteration of our certification program in ACS, which is doing quite well. It's beginning to grab and gain recognition for our members and from industry. Since 1999, I have been incredibly committed to the ACS and through it to the cause of professionalism. I think young ICT practitioners anywhere in the world could do worse than get involved in their computing society, whatever it's called, because it's a training ground for management, for understanding how to get what you want out of people, out of programs, and I can highly commend engagement with your professional body to any of your listeners who are in that position of thinking, will I or won't I? Go for it is my word.
What strikes me about the ACS is that they're probably one of the most innovative groups in the world and very much interested in sharing their expertise and so on. So let's explore that a bit. What value does the ACS bring both regionally and internationally?
Well, ACS is about to turn 50 as an organization in 2016, and it has a great deal of experience as a professional society. It enjoys a reputation amongst governments and industry, and it plays an important mentoring role for countries in the region, and is a member of ICIP and Southeast Asian Regional Computer Confederation, and is a partner host organization for the APICTA Awards held each year in a regional country. It has a well-developed continuing professional development program, which is deployed in South Africa, in New Zealand, and has students from the United States, from Canada, from Qatar, from a number of other places around the world, who find value in undertaking the courses that are offered online through the CPD program of ACS. It's iterated its certification program to the current well-defined program, which IP3 accredited in 2007. It was the first society to, a member of IP3 to have that recognition. And the value of this program, this certification program and its accreditation means under IP3's aegis is that it provides the mutual recognition of similarly globally accredited programs of other members of IP3, such as the Canadian Information Processing Society, which is the other member that's accredited by IP3 at this stage.
This is clear from your history and also from all the work that you do currently that you have a very, very strong interest in the ICT profession. So what does the ICT profession mean to you, and why should the audience care?
The passion I mentioned earlier is what drives me in this. I believe that ICT is a fundamental enabling technology that underpins a number of others, and this makes it vulnerable to poor practice standards out of ignorance and lack of integrity. Those who dabble in ICT at home provide just as much a point of vulnerability as the most sophisticated practitioners in the best practice companies, because we're all connected at some point. If our practitioners are not professionals and supervised by other professionals, what assurance do I have, or any other citizen of this or any country have, that our lives are safe, our privacy valued, and our rights protected? It's vital that those who would connect with others in ICT have an understanding of ethical behaviour, of professionalism. And that's why I believe the audience should care.
Brenda, you mentioned professionalism, so let's go into that in a little bit more detail. What is meant by ICT professionalism, and why should the diverse ICT stakeholders get involved?
Well, I guess it follows on from the previous comments that one definition, the British Computer Society, for example, they suggest that a professional is a practitioner who has specific skills rooted in a broad base, has appropriate qualifications, belongs to a regulated body, who undergoes continuous professional developments, who operates to a code of conduct, who recognises personal accountability, and has both skill and competence. That's the definition that they use for a professional. ICT stakeholders who value those qualities and the outcomes that they bring with them will get a payoff. The payoff is effective risk management. If you are an employer employing ICT practitioners, if they're a professional, you know what their value position is. You know how they will respond in a given set of circumstances. You will be able to understand their capacity and capability that they bring to your organisation. So when you're tendering for work, you will know what skills you do not have in existence in your company, because you have professionals who are constantly working to develop their skills and are committed to a lifelong learning model. So for me, ICT stakeholders must get involved in order to ensure that the product that they're producing, the product that they're buying, the people, are in fact what they need when they need it.
Now, what is IFIP IP3, and how do you get How did you get into your current role?
Well, IFIP IP3 is a global program. It's IFIP-led, it's independent, and it's not-for-profit. It's delivered through member societies. It's about promoting professionalism. It's about defining global standards. It's currently creating international infrastructure and it's recognizing and certifying professionalism. And it's doing those through a partnership of stakeholders in the ICT ecosystem, governments, companies, practitioners in their professional society, and through companies that know that professionalism is, in fact, an effective risk management strategy. I came to the current role in IFIP IP3 as the ACS representative. I was asked last year if I was interested to stand for election as the chairman, and because it's kind of a natural follow-on from my time as the ACS vice president membership, and in recognition of my passion, or as an outlet for my passion, to achieve recognition for the program and to grow it to a broader audience. So that's how I came to be sitting in the chair of IFIP IP3.
Brenda, what do you hope to achieve in the short and long term with IFIP IP3?
I have relatively modest ambitions for IP3 in the short term. I need to have people recognize this is a journey and not a destination. I think to grow our membership of ICT professional societies and to grow our partners in industry and government is our principal mission, and to spread the message that professionalism is the most effective risk management strategy businesses, governments and economies have in applying ICT as ubiquitously as it is. So my short-term goal is to continue to grow ICT IP3, and my longer term is probably to make IP3 somewhat redundant. But that's a very long way away, and I think it's probably not something that will be on my chest to do. It'll be someone who's much younger than me today to see that out.
Brenda, you are an amazing leader, and I know many of the leaders worldwide with corporations and within government and academia, and you definitely are a standout. You're also the first woman chair of IP3. Do you think that provides added perspective as a pioneer in that role, or maybe in other roles that you perform?
I generally don't think of myself with respect to any gender. I just try to play to my strengths and have others do likewise. Having signed up to the mission of IP3, I guess there are general characteristics that women have, like trying harder to be effective at communication and in providing support, but there are equally plenty of men who are better at this than I profess to be. So I'm not sure that being a woman in this space does actually add anything to the job and to the role of chairing IP3. It might provide some novelty value, perhaps, and certainly in the developing countries, it's perhaps a little novel. But no, I don't think gender has a role to play here. I think there are two schools in ICT, one which promotes that women must have a voice separate from their colleagues. I've never subscribed to that view. I've always felt that if you're a coder and a chap sitting next to you is a coder, you've got the same sorts of issues, and you've got a common problem to solve. It doesn't really matter whether you're a boy or a girl. And that's where I sit on this subject.
Why should governments, academia, industry, countries, other computing societies get engaged in IFIP IP3?
Well, if you work in ICT, then you should ensure that your professional body is a member to maximize your opportunities to continue to learn, to grow in your profession, and be recognized and rewarded as a result. If you own an ICT company and you want to better manage your risk and understanding your capability, you should be promoting the IFIP IP3 project, because that's what we do through our member societies. If you're a government, you need to know what skills your economy needs in order to prosper in a global ecosystem. ICT is unquestionably a global profession, always has been, always will be. There are no boundaries to ICT these days, not geographical ones anymore, despite government's wish that it perhaps was so. So I think because we don't have often the opportunity to have a body that's set up internationally to to recognize the global nature of the profession. It's really in your own interest as one of the stakeholders to ensure that your point of view is capable of being heard and that your needs are being addressed by the member societies that your employees should and probably do belong to.
For clarification, I should point out to the audience that IFIP is the International Federation for Information Processing, founded by the United Nations back in 1960, and is the official consultative body for the United Nations in ICT, but also is a sector member for the ITU and also is part of a global science council. And IP3 is the International Professional Practice Partnership, of which Brenda is the chair. Now, for the next question, you have done a lot of speaking lately, again, because of the prominence you have globally, because of the amazing things you've done in your career. Can you share the value of the ITU-UN WSIS conference and your work at WSIS, and what were your takeaways from WSIS?
Okay, WSIS is the World Summit on Information Society, and it's a project that's been going since around 2000. It's chaired and sponsored by the International Telecommunications Union of the United Nations, and it's set a number of pathways going to improve infrastructure, improve literacy, reduce the digital divide in a global sense of participating countries, and ITU has member countries from around the world. It's a forum of, I actually don't know the number, but certainly more than 600 people. It gets together to report on progress, and in May, I was lucky enough to go with some of my team to WSIS in Geneva, and it was a huge platform, a great platform for IP3 to promote its message to leaders in government and industry around the world. We had senior directors, vice presidents of the leading corporations such as Intel and Dell, rubbing shoulders with civil society groups involving women and disabled and developing countries, director generals of departments of infrastructure and communications. It was a fantastic opportunity, and one that I've actually known about since its earliest days and have never expressed an interest in until more recent times, and boy do I feel foolish now. I believe that in my own case, in my own country, there was no representation of Australia at that forum. The fact that it's a European community, at least headquartered in Geneva, doesn't mean that the whole world shouldn't be there. And the message I brought back from that forum for my own country, my own society, ACS, was that we need to get out there. We need to encourage our government to get involved, to report on the infrastructure that we are, the infrastructure steps that we in Australia are taking, and to reduce, and what are the steps we're taking to reduce the digital divide and improve the digital dividend, of Australia. So, and again, in a mentoring role, if not, as a learner of what other countries are doing. So to me, it's a wonderful opportunity to see and be seen in a meaningful sort of way, not just in a voyeuristic sort of way. I believe that as the project, the WSIS project, comes to its end in 2015, I think there's been a great deal of good achieved in reducing the digital divide and in providing infrastructure in developing countries and establishing those networks of individuals and equipment that are going to be so essential to take the next steps for the developing economies.
I just wanted to add that the ITU, the International Telecommunication Union, is represented by something like 193 country governments and over 700 corporations and organizations, and basically regulates, governs, and sets standards for the global ICT industry worldwide, and is a significant force. So basically, if you have that many countries involved, you need to get involved with this World Summit that you indicated. And you had an opportunity to ask questions, to speak, and to address all the members that were there, the delegates, several times throughout the entire summit. So just a remarkable job.
Well, thank you, Stephen.
Now, Brenda, you have traveled extensively in 2011 and 2012. What lessons can you share from each of these events in your travels?
Well, probably, Stephen, the first thing that struck me is related to the last trip I did recently, which was to the PICTA Executive Council meeting in Brunei last month. I wouldn't normally be attending such a meeting. I was filling in for someone who was sick. But what I found was these are industry associations typically, those that represent employers and multinationals most often, rather than the professionals, practitioners that I'm used to. But in the room, there were two countries, economies as they call them, that actually had their president of their computer society at them. And I just thought, wow, it's an imperfect world, an imperfect knowledge, but gee, if you can just understand where those connections are. And as a result of being at that meeting and promoting IP3, I've actually been able to take some steps to engage with these two countries, these economies, to encourage their participation in a meaningful way in IP3. And if not, at least to understand what IP3 is. So I guess connectedness, networking, leveraging the imperfection of the knowledge state that we each have to try and improve on that. I've travelled to Geneva, to India, to Malaysia. I've met with governments and with industry associations and professional bodies and individual practitioners, and as well as companies and employers. And it's been a remarkable experience, and the one thing that perhaps sticks out in my mind is the global connectedness. It matters not whether you're operating from Bangalore or Kuala Lumpur or Penang or Geneva. You're using the same infrastructure, the same internet, the same global standards, the same products, the Microsofts, the Oracles, the open source. And you're interconnecting in a global environment, a global ecosystem. We are impacting on each other every day, and we need to understand what the actions that I take today in Adelaide, South Australia, do in fact impact on what's happening in New York and in Mumbai, and take that into account as we do what we do.
We have many listeners out there, and there could be computer society leaders who are also out there of the various countries. If they wanted to get involved with IP3, where do they go? What do they do?
They make themselves known to us. We are a partnership. We tout ourselves as a partnership. We don't really care whether you fit the mold that our terms of reference allow. We want to grow the influence and the impact that our message has and ought to have. So we welcome everyone. We have our members who are professional societies typically. We have our Global Industry Council, which is senior leaders in and around industry around the globe. And these people are vital as influencers of practices within their companies and within their ecosystems, their own ecosystems. If you're a member of a professional society and you want to get us to help your professional society do it better, do it more, do it, whatever it is, then get in touch with us. We have a website at ip3.org. And we welcome your using the email addresses that are on there. I'm widely available. My email address is in Google. Just look for me. You'll find me. By all means, feel free to drop me a line, and I'll be happy to engage with you to see how we can work together to advance your cause in advancing my cause of IP3.
Brenda, you are an expert in security and risk management, so can you share some best practices and useful lessons from your work?
My interest in security and risk management is on the people side, not the technology side. I barely know how to install a virus protection product, in all honesty. But I do believe that the single point of weakness in all security and risk management is people. And therefore, I'm vitally concerned that we have people who've had the benefit of a professionalism approach. They're certified professionals by their professional society. They have been taught and understand and practice the lessons of security, information security, security technology, and understand risk management, the risk to the company. I was talking to an employer of a relatively small company, 30 people in this company, who says the bane of his existence is the zealot, the software developing zealot who insists that every single little foible has to be dealt with at no matter what the cost. And it's his role in life as the managing director to educate these practitioners that in an ideal world this would be in fact the way to go. But the way they are going, they will be broke before they can implement it because of the time involved in doing that. So I think people need to understand, ICT people need to understand the business context they work in. And it's been one of the things that I've concentrated on in most recent times is to understand that balance between perfection, which we all strive for, and reality, which we must face.
When you survey the landscape out there, what do you see as the most disruptive technologies and how can we best manage them?
Technology, toys and tools. They're the ones that, the smartphones, bring your own device. I believe that this is breaking down a huge number of former boxes that used to exist around practices, around performance, around expectations. I think that open source has the potential to be disruptive because it's not about the software, it's about the way the software is created. It's about the ways of working. So I think workplace, I think in recent times in Adelaide, the Microsoft office here has taken on a whole new persona that wouldn't be comfortable for many of the oldies that were around, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, where it's hot desking and where you don't own the space you turn up in every day. You may sit at a different place, and that brings discomfort and that brings a sense of alienation. And I think these are the things that disrupt but have the most power to bring about the most sustained improvement. And they recognize the way people work today, the way Gen Y and the millennials approach life and work today. And I think these are probably the biggest disruptors, and I think they're terrific. I'm a bit of a subversive, always have been, and I think anything that makes a worker or an employer or a government stop and ask the question, why is this happening or why isn't this happening? And considering what the answers might be and choosing between those answers is a good thing, in my view.
Brenda, you travel extensively. You have spoken around the world. You've worked for some time in a number of different domains. Do you have any stories to share? Maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Well, I think I've already shared most of my good stories with you, Stephen. So I'm not sure there's anything left to share with you at this point in time.
Okay. Well, even your response makes me smile. Well, Brenda, we're at the very end of our interview here, and I always turn the table, or turn the tables, I should say, in the last question, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
I'm not sure I can spring for three questions, because I'm not as good at this sort of thing as you are, Stephen. But I think the first question I would ask is, what must I do to get IP3 more broadly understood and more broadly out there so that people can understand the mission of IP3 and could understand the messages of IP3. What would be my answer to that one? Probably doing what we're doing, but with more support, with more traction within governments, more financial support from our industry supporters where possible, and through having more resources available to spread the work out. Like many things in ICT, it's a volunteer-led, volunteer-driven enterprise. There's very few dollars for salaries or wages, so sponsorships from those in a position to provide such things would be clearly advantageous in order to expedite the message. I certainly don't see that IP3 story will be told in the short term. It is a long-term thing, and the reason for that is not everybody's ready to undertake the sorts of programs that we offer. Not every professional society, not every economy is able to participate in the way that an Australia is, or a South Africa is, or Canada is. So, we've got people just starting the journey, and we in IP3 want to take that journey with them to help them a little faster, perhaps, because today, time doesn't wait for anyone. The global ICT performance is there 24/7, 365 days. So that's one of the questions. The second question would be, when are we going to be able to have industry and employees work more effectively together on the professional skills of their workforce? I believe that industry does not, because of the cost presumably, provide the level of support to their workers, to grow their workers. And it's a two-way street. New workers tend to move on more quickly than older workers did. I think the cost of training and retraining and training again the next crop is very high. But I think there ought to be more work integrated learning for university and education providers. I think in the vocational education sector, I think there ought to be more work placements available. And of course that takes a commitment from industry, which is not cost free. We understand that. But I would like to, I'd like to explore ways that, that might become more achievable. And for a third question, I might ask the perennial one that I denied existed before, which is about women. Currently, women are 50%, roughly speaking, of the population, and yet they're only somewhere between 11 and 17% of the ICT workforce. What might we do? How might we address this? And how might we encourage women to be more participative in the ICT, in practice of ICT? The answer, I wish I knew, because if I did know, we'd have been doing it in ACS for one for the last 2 years, and I think it would be true that it would be better than 11 to 17% if we all knew the answer. So I'll have to leave that one open to your audience to participate in, Stephen.
Well, Brenda, that's a pretty good series of questions and answers that you provided, and thought-provoking as well. Now, I want to thank you for coming in today. I mean, you have a very busy schedule, and for you to take the time to express your views and to share some of your history and your experiences, and to do a call for action to get people involved in developing the profession and also professionalism is just a remarkable thing. So thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
My pleasure, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Brenda Ainslie, Chair, IFIP IP3, Global Authority in ICT.